So tonight, continuing on, let's see, The World Could Be Otherwise by Norman Fisher. Imagination and the Bodhisattva Path. And last week, I suggested that you might want to pick one of the generosity practices in this chapter to do this week. If I had given myself that assignment, I would have completely forgotten about it the second that I logged off. So I'm not expecting that you did, but did anybody do that who is interested in sharing their experience? Pick one of those. There was a lot of neat practices at the end of the chapter, just little things that you could do either in your meditation or throughout your day. Speak now or forever hold your peace.
I can't say that I chose one deliberately. I can't even remember if I was here last Tuesday. I don't remember the question. But as I was reading it, the book today and reading through the practices, I am one of those people who wipes the sink in public restrooms. But I haven't been in that many lately. But I do have the habit of doing that, just to make it nicer for the next person. So I guess that's a halfway yes.
What did you say? You sing?
I wipe up the sink.
Oh, okay.
I sing in public bathrooms.
That's what it's.
I think that would not be beneficial.
Anyone else?
Since I haven't had in-person Zen community for a while, I got out of the habit of just bowing to my food before eating. And so I didn't compose a grace. I think one of his suggestions was to compose a grace before meals. And I'm because of my childhood background, I'm not so much interested in that, but I got back into the habit of bowing. And since there's no one else to tell me how many times I could bow, I started doing it three or four times, once the food, just as it is on the plate. And then the second time, just imagining the vegetables themselves, in their raw form growing. And then the third time, maybe bringing in some of the humans responsible for cultivating it or, stocking the shelves in the grocery store with it, and kind of widening the circle. So that's been pretty cool to bring that back.
Sweet. Thank you for sharing. Sam.
I have been giving myself the gift of fearlessness. And I've shared that thought with a couple of different people, and they voiced appreciation for it and said they will do the same for themselves.
And how do you want to say anything about how you're doing that?
I am doing that primarily by not looking into the future of next Monday when I have surgery and not getting anxious about it and working really hard to stay in the present moment and not project to what's going on in the future.
Thank you.
I noted one said, do something every day for your health and well-being. One of the things I haven't been doing, we bought a treadmill last year and I used it a lot until we kind of hit COVID-19. So that's kind of the thing I'm trying to be more mindful of is using that thing because I'm not as active at work, even though I go to work every day. So I did fairly good this week. Certainly met well beyond any other week before it.
Did it help you at all to kind of think of it as an act of generosity?
Yes, it got me going again. And then the 7 days, I mean, two of them I was really active, and the last thing I wanted to do at the end of the day, get on the treadmill. One day I was just tired because I worked late. So made three out of days wasn't bad. When you run around all day, it's really no point coming home and walking on a treadmill. Most days aren't like that right now.
Cool.
So I had one. There's something that he wrote about. Let's look at it real quick. Oh yeah, I intentionally smile at people. So I walk 4 or 5 miles a day usually, and I always run across people. So I made the point of trying to make eye contact with everybody and smiling at everybody. And yeah, it's good. I generally try to do that anyway, but I was trying to be more consistent at it instead of being lost in thought or, you know, wherever I go. And it's interesting. Most people do acknowledge you. Some people don't. So I guess it just depends where you're at.
So how do you feel when you smile and somebody just kind of blows you off?
I don't take it too personally, partly because I remember a time when I was that person more regularly than I am these days. So I guess, you know, I might feel a little compassion for him, actually. Just a small amount, not too much.
All right. So, I'm really enjoying this book. I look at it and I think, all right, what are we going to talk about? What are we going to cover? And there's so many things. There's so much richness and material without it seeming overwhelming or overly intellectual or anything. So starting on page 41, he's starting to talk about generosity is empty of generosity. So many of you will recognize from our formal meal verse, may we with all beings realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. So emptiness, of course, as Fisher talks about, is not empty in the sense of a nihilistic void, not empty in a bleak sense of meaningless or valueless. It means empty of something that we expect to be there, like a glass is empty or full. If it's empty, you know, it's like there's something we think should be in there, and if it's not there. So in terms of ourselves, in terms of other things, we impute essence into them. One of my favorite examples of this is from the book Why Buddhism is True by Robert Wright, and he talks about it's not even research really, it's like sociology, where people will pay a lot of money in auctions for like mundane items that were supposedly owned by so-and-so, or, you know, participated in some remarkable moment. So he's the example of like a tape measure, like this tape measure was owned by John F. Kennedy, you know, and how people, you know, there'd be some people would pay a lot of money for it. They're like, because even though it's an identical tape measure to one that you might buy at Home Depot, this one, so there's like something, we feel like there's the essence of that tape measure has changed. It's been made special by its conditions. So this is what we do with everything, with ourselves and with objects and stuff like that. So saying that the giver, receiver, and gift they're all empty of inherent, enduring self-nature. So it's interesting to contemplate what this means in the context of generosity. And Fisher suggests that, you know, there's kind of regular generosity, where you're not manifesting the emptiness of giver, receiver, and gift. You know, you're like, I've got something you need it. I'm going to give it to you. And hopefully, you know, there'll be some benefit. And that's fine. Like, there's nothing harmful about that kind of giving. But the, he says, the perfection of giving, the paramita of giving, the spiritual practice of giving. So like all of these, all of the paramitas we're going to talk about. So generosity, morality, patience, meditation, wisdom, like they are all perfections when they incorporate this, the paramita of wisdom, when they incorporate the understanding, the appreciation that all things are empty. So it's like emptiness or generosity taken to another level. So he says on page 42, technically, according to the sutras, emptiness means lacking independent being. This is what things are empty of: independent, solid existence. Nothing is fixed or separate. There are no things, entities, selves, or beings. There is only the flow of reality, the riot of life, the sun of being radiating everywhere. Fisher's a poet. In the light of such understanding, there can be no giver, receiver, or gift. Like everything else, these three wheels are empty. They don't exist as we think they do. Things are not separate from one another. Everything is flow, everything is complete. Since no one owns anything, there is no giver or receiver. Life circulates as a gift. So, as I read this, I got to thinking about ownership. And it says, since no one owns anything, there is no giver or receiver. So I wanted to brainstorm about ownership. What does it mean to own something? What does it mean that something is yours? And then in the second column, you know, then what are the characteristics of something that you can't, you don't own or can't own? So please just go ahead and unmute yourself and throw out some ideas about ownership.
Well, I'll talk. Sorry, did I step on somebody? Ownership obviously is, in one sense, is having something so others can't have it. That's where the word private property comes from, deprivation. Privé in French means to deprive others of it, so by you having it. So that's, you know, that would be a base, you know, having it so that others don't have it, so that it's yours only, temporarily, of course.
I think of like owning a house or other things, it gives you a feeling of safety. I'm just a little bit safer in the world because I own all this stuff.
I apologize if you can hear the drumming in the background.
not bad at all.
My husband is making Christmas music independently together with a band. Oh. But this question makes me think of a page that I tore off of a Zen calendar and had up on my refrigerator for years. And it was a quote that said, if I own a cow, the cow owns me. And I love that because we can easily I think it's easier for us to think of the sense of I own the cow as in it's my possession and here's what I'm going to receive from it. But that saying shows that mutuality, that if I own the cow, then I also become responsible to and for the cow. Wisdom there.
Feels like that almost doesn't quite belong in the second column, but it reflects some wisdom. Yeah.
May I say something that's not to, I don't know, I can't really think of what column it belongs in, but yeah, this is actually something I've thought about pretty extensively, is ownership. I felt that we can never really own anything except for our own experiences, right? Those can't belong to anybody else. It's like in the Cooking with Zen book, How to Cook Your Life. You know, a man cannot even share so much as a fart. That line. The other thing that comes to mind is actually kind of along with the cow is the movie Fight Club. And so in the Why Buddhism is True book, he talks about The Matrix being a Dharma movie. And in my opinion, Fight Club is also a Dharma movie. But in that movie, he says, the things you own end up owning you. Mm-hmm. And he means it in this materialistic sense where, you know, if you're very focused on acquiring material things, you become attached to them. And that attachment is like them owning you, them controlling your behavior, not vice versa. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Hi, this is Peter. I will say that our own experiences that we do not understand would be those that we can't own. You know, I would say that owning something, being connected to it, involves understanding. And if I say I just don't understand it, then I can't own that. I don't know if that made sense, but I'm looking to put something in the second column. So yeah. We cannot.
Oh, you can't. Oh, okay, right.
We can't own it if we can't understand it. Like we can't be responsible for it. It doesn't make sense to us.
I'm going to put that. Cool. So in this ownership category, I encourage people to like, let's think kind of concretely and like socially. Before we go into the profound spiritual realm, how about like when you own something, you get to control it?
Well, when you own something, oftentimes it's defined by the state with certain legal rights in your guardian, particularly a house, a car. I mean, you have a deed or a document that says that you own this. So ownership is sometimes defined by our secular entity that we live in. Certain rights and responsibilities. You own the car, you have to have insurance.
And I mean, controlling something, you know, that has kind of a negative connotation. But on the other hand, if I own something, I have the right to give it to you. I have the right to move this resource or this object, which may convey benefit, over so that it's conveying benefit on you. So, yes, you have the right to give it away.
But it seems like if I own something, inherent in that ownership is some level of attachment. A car, for example. I can say that it's just a car. But if somebody bumps into me and gives me a fender bender or scratches it with their keys or whatever, that's going to hurt me in some way. Mm-hmm. And even if it's a really old car and my attachment over the years has dwindled, if something happens and I lose that car, and that's my means of transportation. So it seems like to me ownership carries with it, whether you like it or not, some kind of attachment.
What about edges? In order to own something, does it have to have, like, be definable, kind of concrete?
No, what is it that you can't own? I was thinking you can't own the air. Right? And that's the flip side of your question. Yeah. Like,
you can literally sell the airspace above your house.
But that's bounded, right?
Yeah.
That's within your house. So in order to, it has to have some kind of boundary.
And ownership at its most basic is possession of something. Because, you know, when I talked about legal definition of ownership, but the other old saw is possession is 9/10 of the law. So you can literally possess something which you actually don't have rights to, but you have ownership of it. You can use it. The owner doesn't know where it is because you have it.
So it's going to be in your physical vicinity or control. You would say, to some extent, can we not own things we can't control? Yes, I'm also thinking of this in terms of generosity, in terms of, you know, the kinds of things that we can potentially be generous with. But oftentimes it's some kind of sense of ownership that impedes that. Or when we give, we're not doing it in this kind of empty sense of, you know, the three wheels just flowing. We're doing it more in that traditional sense, like I have something I'm going to give.
I have something for the other column, which is you can't really own or control other people's feelings or actions.
So in that sense, you can't own them. Definitely not something that you can give.
You can't own your shadow.
Nope. So some of the synonyms of own or possess are control, dominate, enjoy, have, hold, keep, occupy, retain, be in possession of, have in hand, or have rights.
Yes, I was going to mention freedom. You can't really own freedom.
And you really can't own any of the similar kind of like virtues or conditions. That you can't, all of those kind of intangible intangible but valuable aspects of life.
Can you own your time? I was just able to read the first chapter of the book, and then I had to take it back to the library. And when he went to the generosities, he didn't mention time, which I thought was strange, because that's something you can be generous with. But, you know, I like to think I own my time somewhat.
I agree. And I think it has, even though it's, in some senses, it's intangible, it does, in a sense, have boundaries, kind of. It's a limited quantity that we kind of measure.
Right.
And we have control over it. We get to decide what we do with it for the most part.
Right. And I might give an hour of my time to someone.
Yeah.
Oh.
So on, let's see, page 48. He says something else about ownership. Ownership is a social and legal convention, not an actuality. A friend of mine once told me he felt guilty that he owns a big house overlooking the ocean. Don't worry, I told him. It's only temporary. Once you take as real the convention of ownership, the perfection of generosity becomes impossible. Though you appear to own things, you have to remind yourself that this is not actually the case. Then you can be generous without looking for any return. So I was curious, because last class, many of us were finding in the discussion kind of where we find it either difficult or easy to be generous, that most of us had some aspect of our lives that we tend to be a little more cautious about giving away, whether it was money, time, energy, attention, you know, possessions, space, physical space, emotional investment, acceptance, patience. So most of us, you know, have certain things that we just, you know, give away pretty carelessly, don't mind at all. But there's certain things that's like, you know. So I really noticed for myself, sometimes it's my time and not wanting to, being stingy with patience when, you know, something is slowing me down that I don't think should be slowing me down. It's wasting my time or something like that. So I was wondering if you think about that for a moment, and can you conceive of this resource as being something that you don't own? And if so, would it make it any easier to be generous with it? It's like your time, your emotional investment, your money, your possessions. What is it like to think, I don't own that? So kind of contrary to what we were just saying, you know, talking about time, is there a way that I can look at, say, I don't own my time?
I think in a way it's a relief. Because, you know, then it's all this responsibility that you just don't have, and it's much more carefree. That's the first thought that came to me.
I know that when I have the feeling that my time is not my own, I'm very frustrated. I'm usually at the end of my rope by the time I recognize that.
Yes, but if you start out I mean, I guess you can't always be that way. I mean, if you, you know, you do the things you need to do, but then, I don't know, in certain situations, you can just turn yourself over to whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's very freeing.
And Jeanrya, in those situations, are you thinking somebody else owns your time?
I'm thinking everybody else owns my time.
which that to me just seems like it's a similar concept. It's just, so there's still ownership in there. Just somebody mm-hmm. stole it. Kathy? Oh, you're still muted.
Because the drum comes and goes. I think about the relative and the absolute as being informing each other. And it's not that we truly, deeply, intrinsically own something, but it's not that ownership doesn't in some form, in some way, happen. That it's both and so if I think about it that way, I think of like I temporarily have responsibility or stewardship for these things in what's happening here and now in this moment. This is how this is manifesting. How can I act of benefit for myself and others here and now, knowing that it's not forever and always, and like hold it loosely, but not completely toss ownership out the window.
Sam.
Isn't any time other than the present moment a mental construct? If you're doing something you really enjoy, time flies. If you're doing something you hate, it slows to a crawl. The older I get, the faster time goes. It's relative. Yeah. If there were no human beings on the planet, would there be any notion of time? Does any other entity besides humans care about such a notion?
I love the idea of the, you know, speaking in terms of kind of material things. I've always been really touched by this book, The Soul of Money, which is by this woman who, I mean, I took a fundraising workshop with her for nonprofit folks. So that's the kind of thing she does. But I mean, she really, she has a spiritual teaching about money that essentially, you know, our sense of sufficiency can't come from money. And if it comes from somewhere else, then we can see money as a flow, that it flows into our life, and we have the opportunity to, you know, direct where it flows next. But it has a, she has a beautiful way of describing that. And there's a way that, I don't know, it's an interesting shift of perspective for a moment. Like I've confessed before, like I really, in particular, I like my books and I treat my books very carefully and I don't break their binding. And so when I'm, you know, maybe I'm going to lend a book to somebody, and you know how often you lend a book to somebody, you don't usually see it again, just, you know, people forget, whatever. And if you do, they've broken the binding, whatever. So it's like, but you know, if I'm focused on my ownership of this book and like, you know, what I'm giving away, but in a sense, I can imagine expanding my perspective in a way and just thinking, it's almost like this turn toward gratitude of just like, wow, look at this amazing book that, you know, I got to read, came into my life. And now I have the opportunity to, you know, pass it along, and other things are going to come my way. I don't know. It's a very, very interesting shift.
I was kind of thinking of this with ownership. I guess I kind of jumped to a weird place, but with like it's called subcultural theory. It's a strange version. When you were talking about sociology, it's like a sub school of sociology. And so I was thinking a lot about how like there are, you know, like hippies and punks and goths and all these people, and they define who they are through their material possessions and also non-material possessions, like what kind of knowledge you have and your ability to like exploit that knowledge, like you know, cultural material or non-material culture over others. And that our possessions give us really, I think at its heart, a sense of who we are. And that's one of the reasons why we hold on to them, because they're so defining for ourselves, which is where that security comes from. I mean, it's nice to have a house, but if you think about like what you're talking about, your books, you know, it's like, this book is a piece of me, you know, like, and how I treat it is a piece of me. And I've seen so many situations where people use both material and non-material things to create that boundary of that, this is me and that is you, and you don't get to have it because you're not in like the cool club, basically. I mean, like, that's what I'm talking about, though, is like literally like the belonging to those subcultural societies, where everything is kept very much on the down low, you know? And yet if we don't take ourselves so seriously, it keeps us from becoming static. Like, you know, you think of some cultures, like, I hate to say like a hippie culture, but like it's had like a lot of the same, like identifying marks materialistically and non-materialistically for like what, 60 years now. And it's like, it's locked those people who identify with it into place, and that locks you as a person kind of into place. And it keeps you from expanding and growing as an individual. And so if we learn to kind of let go of our possessions and see them more in like a state of play, like, I kind of think of that like being linked to flowing, that you're there to play with them, to use them, but then you can share them, just like you can share toys, like when you're a kid playing. You can get something back from other people too. They share with you as well. I don't know if that really made sense to anyone, but that's kind of what I was thinking about.
So there's so much more in this chapter. I want to get on to something very related in terms of emptiness, the no me and no you. Not so there's no being over here, no inherently no action, nothing is fixed or bounded. And he talks about how if we conceive of a giver and a receiver, we usually vacillate between stinginess. I'm the giver, you're the receiver, I don't know how much I can give. Or if we're really trying to give, then a lot of times that leads to burnout. You know, it's easy to go on one side or the other, not giving enough, giving too much. So he's suggesting that if we can manage to give, to participate in generosity without so much of a sense of giver, receiver, and gift, that it's that we won't necessarily get stuck in stinginess or get burned out. So he says on page 44, we reflect that if these teachings are true, they must mean that taking care of oneself is taking care of others. To sacrifice oneself in an effort to help others isn't the perfection of generosity. It's well-meaning neurosis based on the false premise that I am me and you are you. It misses the other side of that reality, that we exchange one another. I am us. So this is, he's referring to this practice somewhat related to meta practice, where you know, send goodwill and compassion to other beings. You wish that for other beings. There's also the exchanging of self and other. Mm-hmm. So another practice of just of doing that. And he says, if you don't take care of your health, state of mind, and general well-being, what good will you be to others? When people give you gifts in an exhausted or semi-resentful manner, it doesn't make you feel joy. You wish they'd take care of themselves, not you. And the same is true for you. Practice the perfection of generosity with a spirit of abundance and happiness, not resentment and exhaustion. So, I wanted to do this in a breakout because more people will talk, but it's getting kind of late for that. So I'll just throw this out there, and kind of a small group anyway. So just reflect for a moment and then see if you can share an example in your life where there was some kind of generous exchange, some kind of act of generosity, where this real lack of difference between giver and receiver was really obvious. And you might have been the giver. You might have participated in quote unquote giving, you know, you did something for someone, but it felt like a flow. It didn't feel like I have something over here that I am giving to you. And as many people experience in this kind of situation, they feel like they are getting just as much a reward benefit as the person they are quote unquote helping. So you may have been the giver in the situation or the receiver, or maybe this is just something you observed.
An example that comes to my mind immediately is playing music with other people. And if there's an audience, that too, that's a flow that works all the way around.
So in the sense that you are not just sitting up there giving something to the audience.
Right. It's... Well, especially with other musicians, you certainly have to create as a unit. You're giving, obviously, depending on, you know, whatever instrument you play, but you're receiving at the same time, very sort of in the moment too. And though I have not played for a lot of audiences in a long time, there is an energy there too that you can get.
Sweet.
A year or so ago, I shared my home with another Sangha member, and it was wonderful. It really added a lot to us, to our lives, and you know, we had a lot of fun together. But she was always feeling like, "Oh my gosh, I've got to cook you dinner. You've done so much." And she's still talking about giving back to us, and it's ridiculous. I feel like we're square now, but I did get a lot from it, as well as her. I had the space. Why not?
I did a photography project for my chaplaincy program, and I took photographs at the Poor People's Campaign in 2018 and of the vigils and actions at Sheridan Prison on behalf of asylum seekers that were being imprisoned there. And then I gave the photographs to the people that were organizing the events for them to use as they wanted to use. But it was exactly what you're describing, both of the examples that have come before, of this flow of where what I saw was just so beautiful, so much that beloved community in action, and then to be able to see it, connect with it, try to make an image and give that back like a mirror. And people were so appreciative, but I was like, it's a mirror, right? It's a mirror. It's what I see when I see you. And it was just one of the most beautiful experiences of my life. And I feel the same way. Like if I take pictures of a mother and a baby, it's the same thing. It's the flow, back and forth, that I get so much life in the life I see.
I have a close friend who I'm always amazed by the sheer number of friends that he has. He's one of those people you would call a connector. And I think the guy has probably gone to 20 plus weddings for the last, 20 years. And he's just one of those people that he's just always there for you, and you just, he gives you that hug or that handshake. And it's just like, no matter who you are, it just makes you feel so much better. And this is very effortlessly, which, is kind of annoying. But, just seeing people like that, who they just thrive on connecting others and, having this sort of really easy and sort of simple positive impact on people's lives. It's always very, very powerful to see that. I wish it were easier for normal people like us or me to do that better. But It's always great to see.
Well, this reminds me, I was a teacher, and so I think I speak for lots of teachers. I taught second grade, and I just would give my heart, all my time. It was a lot of work, but you get so much back from the kids. And that's what so many teachers are doing, just giving everything, but they get so much in return.
I was kind of thinking the same thing, that teaching is one of those things, and as well as someone mentioned mothering a child, mm-hmm. and then pets are the other one. Mm-hmm. That sort of like you're doing a lot to care for these beings that maybe don't have as much experience or knowledge or something. So there's a lot of giving, selfless giving, but there's all these intangibles you get back. I mean, you don't expect like a little child to give back, but they do. I mean, they do in amazing ways. And so there's that freedom from like transaction, it doesn't have to be give something, get something, because it's just simply you're not on the same plane as that child or that animal or that baby. And so you, I guess, feel for the total, immersing in that relationship or that interplay. Yeah.
When Warren was talking about hugs, I was thinking how beautiful is a nice hug, because nobody is the giver or the receiver, or like both people are. And not at the very same time.
I am going to give you a hug now, John.
We could all use that, man.
Yeah, we could. Who would have thought? Who would have thought that we'd be thinking, oh. Yeah, I remember... when I was just speaking to kids, for many, many years, Dharma Rains on Center, where I trained, had and still has an annual kids' Buddhist summer camp for kids. And it's 1 week long because it's all volunteer, it's all volunteer driven. And it was just really, what is it? High staff to kid ratio. So like, basically we could just let the kids just run around. I mean, we had structure, but during the free time, they could just go off and just be themselves and hang out in groups and whatever. But there was enough adults around that like the whole tone of it stayed very, very positive and nobody was excluded. And so for many kids, it was like the most positive social experience they'd ever had. And that happened year after year. So anyway, like it was so unimaginably exhausting. It was so like dawn until after dusk, nonstop, just, you know, meeting people. There's no privacy. There's no downtime. There's no nothing. It's just constant. And so we all were like completely exhausted at the end of the week. But, you know, I don't think any of us had so much fun. That was just the absolute, you know, pinnacle of our year. It was just so much fun. And, you know, that's like, who's giving us the fun? It's all just part of the participating in that flow. Let's see. Well, thank you for your wonderful stories. We only got halfway through my outline, but you know, it's a good book. It's like the second part, like to be content is to be generous. The whole part about being content. Then freedom from fear. Yeah, well, I recommend the book. I was tempted to just cover that next week, but you know, we'll be doing this book forever. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think we should go on to the next chapter or should we just spend another week on this chapter?
Yeah, we haven't talked about fearlessness, so that would be a good thing, I think, to talk about.
Fearlessness, contentment, and fearlessness. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll kind of scooch the schedule a little bit and then we'll just.
What if we take longer than we planned?
Yep, big deal.
Next week is election night, so
we'll talk about fearlessness.
Oh, I know. So like I feel like we might be a smaller group than usual because some people will be watching the returns, but the people who are here will really want this to be happening. So we'll be here.
Skipping to fearlessness, I don't see that.
What is it called? He talks about, I don't know if he has a heading, I don't know if it's a subheading or not. Let's see, protection of generosity. It is verses on the, it's the last section before practices, verses on the perfection of generosity.
Oh, okay, yeah, okay.
And the one before that is the one that's is Dogen, and it's the to be content is to be generous.
Yeah, okay.
All right, I will just
thank you.
Close with our, we dedicate the merit in an act of generosity of our Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna.
Thank you, Damyo.
Thank you all for being here.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Night.
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 Good.
Night. Bye.